From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Desire cuts many ways. It can be the craving that ruins your marriage. It can be the fuel that spurs your highest accomplishment. It can be both. Philosopher William Irvin has taken a fresh look at the roots of desire, at the neuroscience, evolutionary biology, psychology, and history of wanting. We are all part of it, he says. If Olympic medals were given for desire, says Irvin, we would all make the team. He's looked again to Tolstoy and Freud, to Buddhism, the Amish, Catholic saints, and ancient Greeks and Romans for lessons on how best to deal with desire, for chocolate, for sub-zero refrigerators, for inner peace. This hour On Point, the philosopher is in. We're taking a fresh look at our infinite wants, their origins, and how to handle desire. You can join the conversation. Are we prisoners of desire? Are you? Do you celebrate desire? Do you fear it? Does understanding it make it any less powerful? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Dayton, Ohio, is William Irvin, professor of philosophy at Wright State University and author of the new book, On Desire, Why We Want, What We Want. Professor Irvin, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have you.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning to our guests.
William Irvin, let's get straight in here. You say that we are more in the grip of desire than we may be often consciously aware of. You describe it as like the fan in our computer. Never stops running until we forget the sound of it, but it's always there.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about desire. It's always on within us, and the problem is it's always been that way throughout our life, so we don't realize it. It's only if we do something to try to stop the flow of desire. For instance, if you practice Zen Buddhism, you might practice a form of meditation called Zazen. And when you do this, you try to empty your mind of all thoughts. And the first thing you realize is how incredibly difficult it is to do that. And many of the thoughts that enter your mind are desires, thoughts reflecting desires.
And the range of desire that you see people marinating in all the time?
There is just such a wide range of desires, from small desires, trivial desires, up to the huge life-affecting desires. The one that usually strikes people at some point in their life is falling in love, which is this incredible and unexplainable desire to be united forever with some one person.
And that's just a big one. You describe kind of wave upon wave upon wave of desires. You talk some about how to escape from desire, and that's interesting in itself, whether or not that's the goal. I'm looking here at the latest issue of Time magazine. On the front, the big cover is ambition, and you know, shows people striving up to greater things, greater deeds. It seems to me that at some level, Americans are all about celebrating desire. You look at part in escaping it. What can you? I mean, you've got this wonderful quote in the front here from La Rochefoucauld, I guess, says, "Little is needed to make a wise man happy, but nothing can content a fool. That is why nearly all men are miserable." William Irvin, what have we learned about desire? You write about the science that's been brought to bear on this. What do we know now about desire that we didn't know when the ancient Greeks and Romans wrote about it?
Well, let me first clarify one thing. I guess the idea of overcoming desire is impossible. If you have zero desire, you're mentally depressed. You're in a terrible situation. The goal should be to master desire in the sense of having some control over the desires that take hold of you and trying your best to deal with them in an appropriate way.
Then before we go to the science, if you raise mastering desire, I have to turn to our master of desire, Jack Beatty. Jack, give us your first view on this. Are you looking for mastery of desire? Are Americans looking for that? Is that the human condition, Jack, to always try and master desire?
Well, it has been, but, you know, my feeling about modernity, I mean, part of what modernization means, it seems to me, is that the more chronic condition is desire for desire. that is one of the defining aspects of our age. And why? Well, one reason is that our desires are so captured by commerce, that we live in a kind of distraction of desire, that constantly we're being made to desire things we really don't want, that won't make us happy. And the effect of that, over time, it seems to me, is to atrophy and alienate us from our own authentic desires. So I understand what the professor is saying, but I think he may have the wrong prescription for our time.
Maybe. William Irvin, how about it? Do you see Americans as living in a kind of hyper-excited state of desire, or this more attenuated, you know, ennui-filled, alienated, modern state that's shy on deep desire?
Well, it's only been in the last 30 years that psychologists have really come to recognize the irrationality of desire and how out of control we are when we form them. But advertisers knew long ago that our desires are irrational and developed a bag of tricks they could use to try to get us to form certain desires and then as consumers act on those desires. And one of the things that would be involved in mastering desires is the realization that there's people out there who get up at the crack of dawn every morning and spend their day trying to figure out a way to get a desire into your head that you will act on and make them a living.
Clearly, they're at work on that, but Jack sees us as potentially captives of that commercial form of desire, cut off from, I don't know, a richer, deeper flow of human desire. In your work as a philosopher, in your work as a social observer, do you see that?
There are these deeper desires. Many of them are just as irrational as the desires that the advertisers will attempt to foist upon us. The trick is, you're this engine of desire. There are going to be a number of desires that bubble up from deep within you. It's a consequence of your evolutionary past. So, although these are all natural desires in some sense, some of them are desires that you want to act on. Some of them are desires that you don't. The mere fact that you detect a desire that seems authentic and seems to come from within you, from that it hardly follows that you want to act on it.
Take us, if you would, into the science of desire and what we've learned about it. What do we know about it that Socrates didn't know, let's say, or Seneca?
Well, neurologists have done a number of experiments, and they've done research with patients. And they've revealed some really amazing things. Let me tell you some stories from the neurology of desire.
Please.
One of these involves a thing called alien hand syndrome, where literally your left hand doesn't know what your right hand is doing. These are patients whose brains, the two hemispheres of their brains, can no longer communicate properly. And as a result, the hemisphere that controls the left hand and the hemisphere that controls the right hand are out of touch with each other. But these hemispheres form desires independently of one another. So there's a story of a man who would attempt to play chess, and every time his right hand would make a move, his left hand would take it back.
What does that tell us?
Well, what that tells us is that, in fact, well, two things. You have these subconscious forms of desire, and secondly, there are multiple sources of desire within you. I mean, it would be one thing if all of your desires were formed in your conscious mind, because that would be one source of desire, and you'd be on top of that. You'd know how to deal with that. But in fact, you have competing sources of desire within you, giving rise to desire. And then the question is, you're a divided engine of desire. And some of the desires you form are going to be contradictory desires.
So the wellsprings of desire, some you say we can track through evolutionary biology, that must be to flourish and to dominate, I guess, if evolution is the measure.
Well, you can track back many of the things we want and try to figure out why do we want them. And the answer is because our evolutionary ancestors a million years ago, and even beyond that, our evolutionary ancestors survived and reproduced because they wanted certain things. We still want them. Among the things they wanted, for instance, they wanted to mate. They wanted social status of some form. They wanted material possessions. They were never quite satisfied. An evolutionary ancestor who was easily satisfied probably didn't survive. another evolutionary ancestor who, no matter how much he had, always wanted just a little bit more, just in case. He survived, he reproduced, and we are the offspring all these generations later of those evolutionary ancestors. And in some sense, we have it in our blood to want more, to want social status, to want material goods.
I don't think anybody feels any doubt about that, Jack. At some level, then, these are the gifts of the ages, and yet people spend a lot of time trying to flee desire.
Yes, they do. Shakespeare uses the image of wheel of fire. You know, we're trapped on a wheel of fire. And it can seem that way if the desires, if you can't realize them, if they're criminal, if they're, not going to make you happy. But, take a look at what's happened to one of the constants of desires. You go back in the 18th century and you look at those public men, they wanted something called fame.
Mm.
And fame, it's been called the frenzy of renown. They wanted that. And, look what's happened to fame today. Fame is celebrity. It's a cheap coin. Who would want it? You've only got it for 15 minutes. That's an example of what I mean about the attenuation of the structure of desire.
We've got a lot more we're going to dig into here. Jack Beattie, William Irvin, please stand by. William Irvin's new book is On Desire, Why We Want, What We Want. You can join us. Are we prisoners of desire? Are you? Do you celebrate desire? Do you say, bring it on? Do you fear it? Are you plagued by it? Do you see desire as a good, an evil, a mixed bag? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you want? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human desire, taking a fresh look at our infinite wants and what to do about them. Our guest is William Irvin, professor of philosophy at Wright State University and author of the new book On Desire, Why We Want, What We Want. On Point news analyst Jack Beattie is with us as well, and you can join us. How do you judge when to let desire rip and when to put the brakes on? Do you see America as supercharged with desire or cut off from authentic desire? Is desire a burden or fuel for success, for life? And we should call out Buddhists, Mennonites, Stoics. What's your take on desire? Do you have your own? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William Irvin, you quote lots from the ancients here. How was desire understood, thousands of years ago? And was it understood differently from today?
Well, the project started out to find out what people thought about desire, and I decided I was going to go across cultures, and I was going to go back as far as I could into time to see whether there was some sort of consensus view about desire and what we needed to do with it. And what I found was that you can pick almost any culture you want, and you can go back 3,000 years, and what you'll find is that the people who thought carefully about desire all advise the same thing. If you want to have a happy and meaningful life, you need to learn to master your desire in the sense of taking control over it, not simply reacting to any desires you find within you, but being thoughtful about it. And the other thing I discovered was that across cultures and through the millennia, ordinary people have rejected that advice. The ordinary person thinks, if I want to be satisfied, what I need to do is first take an inventory of the desires I find in my head. Then I need to work to satisfy those desires.
Tick them off, one by one. Got that.
Yeah. And that's the obvious, logical way to deal with it, except that it doesn't work, because as soon as you satisfy one desire, another will pop up in its place. And, if you think about the course of your life, how desires work, it's like a river. You know, one desire is gone, replaced by another desire, replaced by another desire.
But isn't that kind of the engine of progress, the engine of the American economy? I mean, we had crisis. President Bush says go shopping. That's partly let your desires flow. Let the energy from desire buoy the nation. I mean, isn't this the fuel cell?
It certainly is the engine of progress, and certainly if everybody aimed for satisfaction instead of worldly success, there'd be less progress. But the interesting thing is, if you have access to the diaries or the notebooks of your great-great-grandfather, great-great-grandmother, and you take a look at them, you'll realize that although they had absolutely nothing that we take to be the essentials of life, they didn't have computers, they didn't have antibiotics, you name it, they didn't have it. Yet they were happy. They seemed to have meaningful lives. I mean, so there's a deeper question mm-hmm. of all this progress. Is it actually making us happier? And the answer is not really. And if you don't believe that, talk to great grandma. You know, if she's still alive, go have a conversation. And her face will light up and she'll tell you about how wonderful her childhood was, even though she had nothing.
And beyond the commercials and advertisements, what have we learned about why we want the particular things we want? If it's not put there by Madison Avenue, where did particular desires come from?
Well, you have two kind of primary desires. One is for social status, and I would again explain that in evolutionary terms. Your evolutionary ancestors who cared about their ranking compared to other people were more likely to reproduce than those who didn't. And then material well-being, the material goods you get that's connected through social status. We want the house that's going to make other people admire us. We want the car. We want the trappings of success because we want other people to love us, respect us, admire us, defer to us. So those two are connected. In the book, at one point, I do this thought experiment. I say, look, suppose you wake up tomorrow and all the people are gone except for you, and you can spin out whatever science fiction scenario you want there. The aliens grabbed everybody but somehow left you behind. Mm. But you've got all the stuff. You've got cars, you know, with the keys in the ignition. You've got stores with jewelry. You've got it all. The interesting thing is you could now have all the material possessions you wanted, except it would be pointless to have any of them, because with no one around to impress, why bother?
Jack Beatty, I wonder about the idea that, yes, they've got money, but it doesn't bring them happiness. I was at the barber over the weekend. He was talking about wealthy clients, and I said exactly that to him, you know, sort of with a half-joking grin. Yeah, they've got the dough, but are they happy? And the barber's response was, well, yeah, they seem like they're doing all right, actually. They're having a pretty good time.
Yeah, that's, you know, we all want to believe that, you know, money doesn't bring you happiness and all the rest of it. But, boy, when you look in People magazine, there isn't a gloomy face. They're all smiling all the time.
Well, of course, that's when they're not checked into the rehab center.
That's absolutely right, and we know the other side of that as well. But, you know, it's true. We do want the status. And in our society, more and more goods, and I think the professor gets into this in his book, are positional goods. That is, they're only valuable because I have it and you don't.
Right.
For example, a Harvard degree.
Yeah.
Objectively, it's not any more valuable than something else, but in terms of its position, by gosh, that's a commodity worth having. And I have it and you don't. But that really is an engine of social dissatisfaction and inequality, the nature of these status goods. But when you think about what makes people happy, it's none of that, really. It's the connections they have with other people. It's their capacity to receive love and to give it. And yes, it helps to have an economic basis for that, but gee whiz, you know, even poor people can love and be loved.
Of course, even receiving love and giving it, those represent desires in a way of their own. I want to begin to turn to our callers who desire to join us. Ron is calling from Alexandria Bay, New York. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you want, Ron?
Well, the question I have is, first let me tell you that I facilitate courses in intuition and creative visualization. And creative visualization utilizes three primary components: belief, desire, and expectation.
Ron, give us an example. Creative visualization for what sort of end?
Well, it's used in across the board. Sports utilizes it quite a bit now. Golfers, quite a few golfers nowadays are taking it, and it's involved. You know, seeing the ball going where you want it, practicing in your off time, just visualizing hitting the correct stroke, and that type of thing.
Yep.
Many sports are using it, but it's also used in business applications and seeing the sale completed and that kind of thing.
Visualize your goal. It will help you go for it.
Right. And seeing it done and desiring it, obviously. That's the largest component of it is the desire. And my question is, in studies, have there been any relationships shown in changing those desires? It was interesting, the left hemisphere versus right brain hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Right hemisphere, intuitive, subjective, left brain, more objective. We try to connect the hemispheres to work together. And have there been any studies in that direction, and have they shown any changes in desire in going from the materialistic viewpoint to a more spiritual, connective, being connected to the source?
So, Ron, if I understand you, you're not looking at a path away from desire, but rather how to harness it for an end, whether it's hitting the golf ball or hitting nirvana.
Correct, yes. And again, it's if we don't have any desires, then we're static. We're stale.
Yep. Ron, thanks for your call. William Irvin, how about it? I mean, here's a very American question, wanting to harness desire for goal achievement, whether it's spiritual or otherwise. Have we learned something since the ancients about how to do that? Is there a science that people are tapping into today?
I don't know about since the ancients, but one of the interesting things I turned up in my research was, if you go back to the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, the ones known as Stoics, who, by the way, were anything but stoical, it turns out, they came up with a visualization technique for dealing with desire. And this might be what the listener is interested in.
What they said is
one of the tricks to becoming satisfied, the easiest way to become satisfied is to learn how to be happy with what you've already got. And then the question is, well, how do you do that? They had this technique, I call it negative visualization, where what you do is take the things you've already got and you imagine them gone. Your job, your car, your house, you can take any aspect of your life and imagine it not being there. And what it does is it gets you not to take it for granted. You suddenly have a renewed enthusiasm for the things you've already got.
So you open your eyes, there's the house, and you're grateful that it's there. Your desire is filled.
You know, the recent hurricanes, you know, they had the people on, and then the tornado that hit this weekend, they had people on TV who, you know, many of them, it's very paradoxical, but they were smiling, and, you know, maybe smiling and crying at the same time.
Yep.
The interviewer would say, what are you thinking? And the people would say, I'm so glad I've got everything that counts. I'm so glad of what I've got. And you look behind, and their house has been smashed to bits.
Right.
What happened was, it isn't negative visualization. Mm. They were faced with the reality of losing something, and then realizing that shocked them into thinking, you know, the things I've still got really are important, and I'm a fool if I take them for granted. And what the Stoics suggested is, you don't need to wait for the hurricane to hit. You can do it just by reflecting on your life, the things you've got, that spouse, that car, that job, and imagine them not being there.
Mm. But Jack Beatty, that sounds like just the opposite of what our caller Ron is looking for. He's got this very American approach. Let's take desire and sort of focus it like a laser on the things we want, not to be happy with what you don't have. He doesn't want to miss that pitch or that sale. He wants to grab them and focus desire like a laser to do that, Jack.
Yes, and he uses the word creative. I mean, that is what creative visualization, but also creativity in life, that comes out of desire, out of wanting here in the world some replica of our dream and of our craving, whatever it might be. And that That it seems to me, is one of the roots of progress and of human advance generally. And it is a shaping of desire, obviously, a honing it to one thing. Freud would call it a sublimation, perhaps. But without it, without being able to project that ahead and say, I want to do this, you're sort of, currentless. It's like making your own current.
William Irvin, this is what Tolstoy was speaking to, if I read you right on that.
Look, let me make a comment about dreams first, and then we'll talk about Tolstoy.
Dreams,
but
sure.
There's one thing about your life is, unless you're an exceptionally unlucky individual, you are currently living the dream. You're perhaps living the dream that you at one time in the past had for yourself. You might have dreamed of getting a college degree, of getting married, of having children, of getting a certain job. And the interesting thing is that as soon as you get the dream, rather than savor the dream that you've accomplished, you go on to form a new dream. And then you think, my life's really terrible because I don't have this next dream. And people spend their entire lives, instead of savoring the dream that they're living, they throw it away and pursue a different dream. And even if you're not living the dream that you had for yourself in the past, you're living the dream of someone else right now. I mean, look at people in foreign lands who are hungry and who are cold and who don't have shelter. They would love to be where we are. So one of the ways to become satisfied is to realize that this life you have is the end product of any amount of desiring in the past. And a sensible person will sit back, savor that life, instead of wishing they could be living someone else's life, or wishing a different life than the one they were living.
I hear that. I absolutely do. It's a very Buddhist view of things, and I can see many angles from which to applaud it. And yet at the same time, we know people who are endlessly energized by that next dream, whatever it may be.
Yeah, the basic choice you've got is a choice between, do you want success, and by that I mean worldly success, mm-hmm. or do you want satisfaction? And it's, for the most part, it's an either-or kind of choice. You can have one or you can have the other. I mean, think about somebody who became a billionaire. He didn't become that way by being satisfied, by being easily satisfied.
This is America. We want to have it all, don't you know, Dr. Irvin?
We do want to have it all. And the question is, if that's what you want, are you going to have a good life as a result? Are you going to go through life a dissatisfied individual? And, you know, there are also people who think, you know, if I could only get success, then I would achieve satisfaction.
Right. And Tolstoy's view from the other end of that telescope?
Tolstoy is an interesting case. He came up in the book. I talk about crises of desire, where somebody, the desires that used to dominate their life suddenly go away, and Tolstoy had what he called an arrest of life. He was successful. He was the most famous writer on the planet. He was wealthy. He had a family. He had his lands. He had everything. He should have been happy. And he woke up one morning and realized that there was no point in any of it. And it took him years to recover from that crisis of desire. And at the end, he was a changed person. He became deeply involved in religion. So it's one of those tricks of fate, you know. A single desire can take hold of your life and alter your destiny. And desires going away can do the same. Another example is Buddha, who was living the good life in the palace and woke up one day and realized, this isn't working anymore. Left the palace seeking enlightenment and ultimately found it. And found it, the realization he had was that desire is the cause of human suffering.
And recommended the so-called middle path.
Middle path between hedonism, where what you do is you just spend your day trying to satisfy whatever desire should pop into your head. In particular, physical desires would be among those. And asceticism, which says you don't do that, you do just the opposite. If you detect a desire in you, you attempt not to satisfy it. Buddha came out in favor of the middle path. He said either of those is going to take you away from true wisdom and a good life. What you need to do is satisfy some desires, refuse to satisfy others.
Jack, are you approaching Buddhahood, my friend?
Well, I'm approaching Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice, but from what I've tasted of desire, I'd sooner fire, though ice is nice and would suffice.
Crank it up. We're talking about human desire, taking a fresh look at our infinite wants and what to do about them. William Irvin is with us. His new book is On Desire, Why We Want What We Want. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about human desire, taking a fresh look at our infinite wants and what to do about them. My guest is William Irvin, professor of philosophy at Wright State University, author of the new book, On Desire, Why We Want What We Want. Jack Beattie's with us as well. You can join us. Are we anywhere near the middle path? Will humans ever master desire? Should they want to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mary's calling from North Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. You know, I'm often a bit frustrated in conversations with my contemporaries by the way we mix up the concepts of want versus need. And sure, I agree that it's driven by advertising and social pressure. I see that personal introspection is generally lacking, and what's more, not even encouraged in our contemporary society, nor is critical thinking about these things. I'm really very grateful to hear a program on this topic.
Mary, let me ask you, though. You make a distinction between want and need, but if desire is at some level hardwired into human beings, is it possible that they really do need things that they simply want?
Certainly. I do believe that we all need social acceptance, love. I'll quote an old song, Nature Boy, which says, "The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return." And I think these things are core to our desire drives. Sure, we need stuff, but I think most of the outer trappings, the house, the SUV, the, you know, fancy vacation, is simply driven by this basic need to love and be loved in return.
And what about in the course of your life, Mary? Have you felt your desires shift, change? Have you gained some little foothold of mastery on them?
Well, certainly. I did raise two children, and at those times when my children were young and they had great need, I fulfilled them by working very hard to get not only what I required myself to survive,
mm-hmm.
but to serve the needs of my children. Yes, Madison Avenue came into that, and my kids wanted
sure.
this and they wanted
yep.
that.
Yep.
But I was fortunate in that I lived in an area where there were not a whole lot of commercial venues that I could just go, okay, I'm going to take you shopping, just be quiet.
Right.
I would keep them occupied with creative endeavors and, you know, just supply them with the basics that they needed to make things, which seem to give them great happiness, and I'm a creative artist. I derive my greatest joy through making things.
But right there is an interesting confluence of desire and need. Your desire was to provide for their needs. Mary, thank you very much for your call. Let's get another call here, if I may, from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Sally's calling. Hi, Sally. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you.
When I think about desire, I don't think about material things. I think about the desire to be a better artist, the desire to see your children make it in the world, the desire maybe to be in a different environment if you're not satisfied with your environment, or the desire to find a partner. And I think those are all pretty positive desires. The mixed bag to me is the desire that people have for each other, you know, the love desire, when that desire sort of burns away all good sense.
Do you mean sexual or infatuation?
Well,
the
falling in love thing.
That's a problem to you?
Yeah, I think it is because so many times it is a consuming sort of thing. It wipes away good sense. It wipes away your ability to discern.
But what about the fireworks and the brilliant sunsets and all the color and spirit
right,
it brings to life?
The color and all of that sort of obscures, really looking at, a lot of times it wipes away, looking at the facts.
good sense, but
there's such a big divorce rate.
Yeah,
so
but it sure can't
like
feel good at the time.
And you do desire it, and it's absolutely wonderful going through it. But if it could be more tempered with good sense, it probably would be more positive for everybody.
A lot to hope for, but we hear it. Sally, thanks very much for your call. William Urban, how about desire when it comes to love and sexuality? Is that in a class of its own? Does it have a higher, plus and minus potential with it?
Well, you know, both of the callers seem to be parents, and both of them seem to take delight in parenthood. One interesting thing about parenthood is if you do it properly, it takes you out of your own desires. You suddenly replace the things. You don't get up in the morning and think, what do I want today? You get up in the morning and think, what does my child need today? And it can actually turn into a tool to get you out of your own desires and put you in a different frame of mind. Falling in love was particularly interesting to me in the research for this book. And in some of the early chapters, I discussed this, because most people will deny that their desires are out of control. Most people will say, you know, I'm in charge here. I get up in the day and I decide what I'm going to do with my day, and I do it. So I'm in charge.
Are they kidding themselves, you're saying?
They are. And a classic example is falling in love. You don't wake up one morning, look at your calendar and say, gee, I have some extra time today. I guess I'll fall in love. It just happens. A bolt from the blue or an arrow from Cupid, maybe, we would want to say. You don't get to choose when it happens. You don't get to choose with whom it happens. And it'll turn your life upside down, no matter how it turns out. I mean, you know, in a way, the best outcome is you get your heart broken and a few months later you're back in the game, but it could end up in marriage. If it ends up in marriage, could end up in divorce, could end up in children, which will certainly change your life.
Yeah.
Key thing is you didn't decide to fall in love.
You were driven. Jack Beatty, we're driven in so many directions by desire. I mean, the appeal of love, sex, infatuation can be just unbelievable. And then, as we hear from Sally, there's also sometimes a desire to be free of all that fireworks.
Yes, that's sort of an autumnal sense, it seems to me. you look back and you say, oh, I was young and foolish. But at least you were young and foolish. The terrible thing is not to have been young and foolish.
Yeah. Let the bonfire go, Jack Beatty says. There, Dwayne's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a great show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask your guests about a kind of contrast that I see in ancient notions of desire. Eros would be the old Greek term, where desire is seen as kind of part and parcel of the entire universe, that we have to train our desires to be at one with the universe. And contrast that with the modern Jean-Paul Sartre, who talks of desire in terms of drinking salt water. It's insatiable. We can never satisfy our desires. In a mechanistic scientific world of material objects clashing together.
So a kind of self-abnegation instead of celebrating it as part of the concert of the cosmos.
Exactly. Part and parcel of the cosmos. Now it's almost in contrast to it. And it's not surprising that the guests are calling and talking about art, you know, that that will, that modern notion that we create something in the face of an indifferent universe.
William Irvin, are we more dour about desire today than the ancients? Dwayne says, you know, he sees them as seeing it as a natural part of the course of things, not salt water necessarily.
Well, the ancients, the Stoics in particular, said you should live in accordance with nature, so they were very much in tune with that. You know, but I would say, if anything, the ancients had more self-restraint than we seem to. In fact, our grandparents seem to have more self-restraint than we do. We live in a generation where if I want something, I better get it, and I better get it soon, because I'm not going to tolerate any other outcome.
What about all those orgies I saw on the Grecian urn? It didn't look so restrained.
Yeah, I know. So we actually had a division, but if you know, and in my research, I had to always kind of distinguish between the ordinary people and the people who were sitting around trying to think carefully about desire. I don't know how many of the philosophers actually took part in those orgies. Oh, I hope it wasn't many.
The subject for a future book, perhaps.
Yes,
Steve is calling for
a few
field work. Steve is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. This conversation reminds me of a quote from Ajahn Chah, the late Ajahn Chah, Buddhist teacher. Uh-huh. He said, if you let go a little, you get a little bit of peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. And I found that saying to have a lot of meaning in my life.
A kind of Buddhist teaching, let go a lot and you get a lot of peace, and let go in no small part of desire itself, Steve.
I'm sorry?
And let go of desire itself
meaning, let's say if you want things to be a certain way, mm-hmm. and if you're holding on to something, that inevitably leads to dissatisfaction or sorrow. But if you're able to let go of it, then then you find it doesn't bother you as much.
Steve, let me ask you.
I found inevitably when there is any type of sorrow in my life, mm-hmm. it's because I'm holding on to something.
Let me ask you about something, Steve. We hear a lot about the globalized world, the globalized economy now. You know, the kind of mixed messages here. On the one hand, let go a lot and get a lot of peace. But we've got other cultures, other nations who are revived and, you know, going gangbusters with huge desires of their own and making great strides. So let's say for the United States, is it better if everyone becomes Buddhist and goes for the middle path and cranks the desire down? Do we end up as a loser in global economic terms if that becomes our guiding light?
Well, I think the key is not to be enslaved to every desire that comes along. And I think meditation really helps, because it sort of like teaches you that thoughts come and thoughts go, and emotions come and emotions go, and that you don't need to like grab onto them as being your emotion or your thought. And so I think the key is to perhaps be more discriminative about what desires we follow.
We hear it, and thank you very much for your call. Let's turn to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Marcus calling. Hi, Marcus. You're on the air.
Hi. I am a psychologist, and I was just a little frustrated with the fact that we haven't really clearly defined what desire is. And in psychology, there are a number of distinctions that are made in terms mm-hmm. of like what might be called desire. So, for instance, non-regulatory versus regulatory states.
What does that mean, Marcus, non-regulatory?
Non-regulatory being things like, regulatory states being things like thirst, hunger, which are necessary just for survival, and sex, which is not necessary for survival, mm-hmm. Per se. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I would just, related to this, I just wanted to point out that DiMaggio's work, like The Feeling of What Happens, basically says there's not a clear delineation between intellect and desire. In other words, like, we need our emotions to tell us what's what logical decisions to make, and when we define ourselves, the emotion is sort of caught up in that. And
he's saying that desire and intellect can't easily be unbraided from one another, that they're of a piece.
Yes, exactly. And if you lose emotion, then you also lose any the ability to decision make and to know what's valuable or meaningful.
So what question would you put to William Irvin on his definition of desire, Marcus?
Well, I just wonder what it is, because it seems to be a multiplicity of things, and we're sort of talking about depression and all sorts of different states that and he's not sort of clearly delineating what exactly he means by desire.
William Irvin, let us step aside and let you do that.
Well, by desire, I guess the most basic definition, it's the ability to hold in your head alternative future states and then choose among them according to some value system. That would be one notion of desire, and a psychologist could come up with a different concept of desire and subdivide it. But the caller mentioned the work of Damasio, and I bring that up in the book, and he's absolutely right. It's a curious thing. We like to think that, you know, we shouldn't let our emotions get in the way of decision making. That we'll make bad decisions if we're if we give our emotions some kind of role. And Dr. Damasio has come across what are hyper-rational patients. These patients have brain dysfunctions that kill off the emotional part of the brain or subdue it, but the patients are just as intelligent as they ever were. And you might think this, so they're like the earthly equivalent of, you know, in Star Trek they had the, what were the creatures in Star Trek that were utterly rational?
Yes.
The Vulcans.
Of course.
So they're like earthly equivalents of that, and you might think they're going to be great decision makers, but as the caller points out, without the emotions to motivate, they simply lose the ability to make decisions. It's an interesting phenomenon and unexpected in many ways.
So once again, the warning not to walk away entirely from desire, not that we could if we tried, but if one does, a kind of paralysis can be there. You write of the eccentrics' advice on desire, and you include Thoreau and Diogenes there. This goes more to social desire. What's the lesson from that view historically, William Irvin?
The principal insight of the eccentrics was that social desire lurks behind a whole bunch of our desires. And a while back, I mentioned that if you look at your material desires, you'll realize that you don't want those things for themselves. You don't want an SUV. You don't want a mansion. You don't want it for its own sake. You want it because other people will admire you or even envy you for having it. But what the eccentrics realized, that if you play that game, if you spend your life trying to win the approval of other people, you're likely to be miserable. So what they do is they head in exactly the opposite direction. They stop caring what other people think. They pay a price for it because we want them to care what we think, but they experience an enormous amount of freedom as a result. So that's one interesting choice we have in life.
Jack Beattie, it sounds to me, at the end of the day, that it comes down to a very personal interaction with desire. It's so deeply embedded in humans, it's always going to be there, I guess. So up to each person, you know, how they open the floodgates or tamp them down, where they channel that desire.
Yes, and, you know, I hear a European flavor from the professor, which I understand and I value. But, you know, this is Scott Fitzgerald's country, where he says we have to believe in the green light at the end of the dock. You know, that in some strange way, America is built on even cockeyed desires, but lots of them. And striving after them, going after that green light, not tempering it, not saying, oh, no, that wouldn't be prudent, but taking that plunge and sometimes falling into the bay between. But that does seem to me to be part of the American birthright, the green light at the end of the dock.
Well, Jack, we wish you luck riding the Bronco. Thank you very much for being with us, Jack.
Thank you.
And William Irvin, author of the new book On Desire, Why We Want What We Want. Dr. Irvin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.